Welcome to the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. The ultimate insider's guide from signing day to the national championship game and everything in between. CBS Sports presents the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast.
Thank you very much, big voice in the sky. Yes, we are back here on the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast. Chip Patterson, joined by Barton Simmons. Barton, as the intro says, you know, we've got you covered, everything from the national championship, national signing day, and everything in between. National signing day is coming up. We will be getting to teams that could be making a strong close here in just a little bit, teams to keep an eye on. But how is the 24/7 Sports, national director of scouting, how's the recruiting world feeling right now as you approach signing day? I imagine that this has been a more stressful time in years past when we haven't had the early signing period to take about 60% of the top prospects off the market.
It's been a less stressful.
I imagine it is less stressful.
It's been a little bit less stressful. Well, I'll say this: like, it's been just less news out there to chase. I think right now, like, typically, we're in like a frantic period where everybody is filling out their class. Everybody's sort of got their arm around their girlfriend, but looking over their shoulder to see if there's a better looking girl at the bar that they can go spit game at. Like, there's this constant movement of trying to flip commitments, trying to sort of evaluate your options and making sure you get the best class available. And now with the early signing period, you got to sort of work with what you got. The majority of your signees already in the fold, and now it's just sort of finishing off the last two or three spots for the most part. Now, there's also some teams out there that have a lot of room left in their class. In most cases, we're talking about the new coaches, and they're just all over the place trying to get volume, get a lot of guys in this final stretch, which are harder to find. And so the remaining uncommitted guys, or the remaining unsigned guys, I guess I should say, there's still more than enough drama around those guys. That hadn't changed. There's just less of them. And I still think as we, sort of creep towards signing day, we're finding that there's still plenty of sort of excitement and drama out there to keep us interested.
So we're recording here on Thursday the 25th. We got, am I right, we got two weekends left of the contact period before things go dead?
That is right. Two big official visit weekends, and maybe we'll catch a couple of midweek visits along the way too. But yeah, it should be two very active weekends on the recruiting trail.
I had to pull up the recruiting calendar. Was writing this week about how about Air Force being able to keep recruiting through a government shutdown.
Yeah, I saw you write that. Recruiting's the lifeblood.
I was like the Air Force Academy, during the government shutdown, all non-essential personnel that are funded by the government, they were not working. They were on government furlough, and that meant that 11 different Air Force athletic events get canceled. But the Air Force Academy knows that football recruiting and football in general needs to be taken care of elsewhere. So, like a lot of football programs, it's essentially funded by their booster club. And because the booster club isn't funded by the government, the Air Force Academy Athletics Fund or whatever, that allowed Troy Calhoun to go out and secure 5 commitments during a government shutdown.
Hey, you said all non-essential government personnel. Recruiting is essential. It is essential to the national security of the United States.
Go Falcons. All right. A couple news items before we dig back into recruiting with an eye on National Signing Day coming up here in a couple weeks. Offensive coordinators. It's really, for starters, let's go with teams that have locked up or secured the way things are going moving forward. Ohio State, after Ryan Day, a coach that has certainly been considered an up-and-comer. And I want to say that we even talked about day with maybe Wilt Fong. We've definitely mentioned his name, or maybe it was with Danny Cannell. We've mentioned his name on this podcast before. Ryan Day, co-offensive coordinator for the Buckeyes moving forward. There was some interest from the Tennessee Titans that he might be going there. Do you look at that as an important person for Ohio State to keep on board, particularly as we look at the post JT Barrett future, which will be, you know, either Dwayne Haskins, Tate Martell? How does Ryan Day figure into the future of the Ohio State offense?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty impressive that Urban Meyer was able to sort of, I mean, that's to me, like, I figured this was a long-term play for him to get back into the NFL as an offensive coordinator. I figured this was just sort of a resume builder for him. And he got his offensive coordinator opportunity, and he got it with Mike Vrabel, and he got it with a a former, number two pick, and Marcus Mariota, quarterback. And he turned all that down to be the co-OC at Ohio State. And I guess, like, one take I heard on this was that Urban Meyer sort of up front, he says to his coaches that he hires, look, I sort of demand 2 years out of you. If I'm going to hire you here, you got to give me 2 years. And that's non-negotiable. And that, I guess, tugged at Ryan Day, and maybe he stuck around because he had given that assurance to Urban Meyer. If so, credit to Ryan Day. But it'll be very interesting to see, I'm curious to see how that impacts, how different Ohio State looks on offense, if he's going to be the guy.
So is he really calling plays now? Like, is this mean that Kevin Wilson is out of the picture?
I think he's calling plays. Now, I would guess there may be some sort of collaboration, like maybe Kevin Wilson gets third downs, or maybe he gets passing situations, or and certainly Kevin Wilson's somebody that's got a lot of, he's a pretty highly decorated coordinator in his own right. So I can't imagine he's just going to be, some nominal co-OC that's just coaching a position. I would imagine that there'll be some pretty strong collaboration and probably some game day interaction from a play calling standpoint too. But yeah, I think that was the announcement that I saw, was that he is, or at least the report was that he will be calling plays, which again was, that's pretty telling that he's taking over some play calling duties from Kevin Wilson. So new quarterback, new style of quarterback, new offensive coordinator, new style of offensive coordinator. Urban Meyer's always going to have his fingerprints on the offense. I guess my lean is that this is probably a good thing for Ohio State. I think we had all gotten a little bit maybe restless with the offense that they had put on the field, thinking maybe they could do more against good competition.
It's just, listen, the JT Barrett soundtrack got played out. We really enjoyed it. There were a lot of hits on that album, but you can only do the world tour but so many times. We need new action.
Yeah, I think we do. I think this is going to be, but like, we were already getting some new action, and this just sort of adds to it. This gives us this may be a whole different genre of music we're dealing with here. So it'll be fun. It'll be interesting, and I'm actually kind of interested to see who even wins the quarterback battle. Everyone's penciling in Dwayne Haskins in Columbus, but Joe Burrow's pretty good.
Oh, that's right.
And he's healthy again, and he's going to have something to say about that competition. And if he doesn't win that competition, he gone, and he's going to be one of the most highly recruited, I would think, grad transfer quarterbacks out there. But he's got a dad who's a coach at Ohio, and he may already have a sort of an idea of where he's going to head if he doesn't win that job.
It had been a minute since I'd been reminded that you are you're leading the Joe Burrow fan club right now.
I'm not even, but I just there.
Don't rule him out.
Yeah, I'm fully I respect what Dwayne Haskins brings to the table, but I think people are sleeping on the Burrow kid.
And one more note on the play calling. This is not anything that would be news to you, Barton, but just for the listeners. let's not act like, yes, one person does have to make a call, but let's not act that at a high level program like Ohio State or at any high level college football program, the game plan is so detailed that it's not like you're calling plays on Madden. And the game plan is put together by multiple coaches, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
They're collaborating, they're building out that game plan, and they're finding the tendencies that they want to exploit, and they're finding the mismatches that they want to exploit, all in this sort of a collaborative effort anyways. Someone's got the call sheet and someone's, you know, signaling in the plays, but I would think that they're, again, and I think in a lot of cases you'll see where situationally a different, you know, hey, all right, what's the run call here for third and short? And then the run game coordinator throws, you know, gives that call. And so there's, I think there'll be some level of that kind of collaboration as well.
I think that there's a lot of fans that sometimes will get hung up on the play calling duties. It's important, but I think that it sometimes that ignores the collaborative nature of all the work, of the hours and hours and hours and hours of preparation that go into what happens on Saturdays. Speaking of that process, that collaborative process, Mike Locksley worked his way up.
Hey, before we move on from Ohio State, how about Mike Vrabel going down his list and stealing or making a run at a second Ohio State assistant coach and getting him and Kerry Coombs, the cornerbacks coach, who's been absolutely spitting out first round draft picks at cornerback for Ohio State. Now he's going to the Titans with Mike Vrabel, which I think isn't insignificant given how, I mean, incredible the development. And not just, look, they've been recruiting at high levels, so that's not a surprise that they're getting NFL draft picks at the position, but they're getting first round draft picks on the regular. Denzel Ward's going to be the next one this year.
Marshawn Lattimore was one of the best rookies in the NFL this past season.
Yep. So, like, I think that's a significant hit, or at least a not insignificant hit, and I think that's a great hire for the Titans. I've from afar, it's hard not to be really impressed with what Kerry Coombs has done in just molding that position at Ohio State.
What's and that's recent, right? Like that. I mean, we're sitting here on Thursday. That's this week.
Yeah, maybe yesterday, maybe Wednesday that broke. So Mike Vrabel not scared to scour the college ranks and the Buckeye staff for his next guy. I wonder if Larry Johnson's next for the defensive line.
Oh, that would be a hit. That would be terrible.
I almost feel like he's got to just like go and make some NFL hires. But hey, Larry Johnson probably wouldn't be a bad hire either.
What's the Kerry Coombs as a recruiter? A big part of that. I mean, Ohio State's Urban Meyer is one of the best workers. You've always described me, you know, like somebody who really changed the game in terms of the role of the head coach as a grinder. But there was, I imagine, was Coombs a big part of also acquiring that talent?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he's in there this year he recruits a defensive back position at a high level, like that. He's in there with a lot of their top targets there. You know, he recruits the state of Georgia and the Midwest. I mean, he's a good recruiter, and he's a, you know, he gets the guys on campus and then he gets them developed as well. So I think he's like, you gotta be a good recruiter. And I think you just, for Urban Meyer, like that's going to be an expectation and that's going to be something that he demands, and you have no choice but to be a good recruiter, I think, under him. But certainly, you know, they'll be okay on that front. I just think from a, you know, coaching standpoint, you know, that's a loss for them.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, Mike Locksley. This was, when we talked about the Alabama offensive coordinator opening, you know, there were all the rumors and the discussions about some of the splashy outside hires, and I don't even know, as we record this, I don't even know if Alabama's necessarily even finalized this announcement, though it is widely reported and pretty much been accepted, because Mike Locksley, if he did not get the job, my understanding was he was going to be a top candidate at Florida State. Florida State has moved ahead and hired an offensive coordinator. All the local Alabama people reporting Locksley is going to be the offensive coordinator. This is a uh, this was a move that I kind of think this was the smart one. I know that there has been some, you know, it's been a good coaching rehab spot for, you know, Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian, but I think that after a couple years rising up from offensive analyst to being a coach on staff, you know, this was the player who was Damian Harris's pick. Damian Harris, among many Alabama former and current players who decided to weigh in on the decision. And if you're a good recruiter, and I think that Loxley is especially important, you know, very much to the D.C. area where he has roots. And if you don't, you know, and if you've been there and you know what Coach Saban wants, then I think that this was a great way to not add any disruption for an offense that certainly looks locked and stocked for next year.
I agree. I mean, this was the move that I thought made the most sense, if only because you don't want to screw up this opportunity that you got. And if you bring in an offensive coordinator that's going to change things, that's going to bring new terminology, bring new philosophies, then all of a sudden there's that risk. And I think this is a low risk hire. What's going to be fascinating to me is when Alabama wins the national title. I think that there's a pretty good opportunity that they'll win a national title next year. And if they win a national title next year, it'll be because of the offense primarily. And so then all of a sudden you got Mike Loxley, who is the offensive coordinator. Let's just go down this rabbit hole and make some assumptions. Let's assume they win a national title and it is like the best offense in college football. And it is the best offense that Alabama's had. And Mike Loxley's the coordinator for it and the play caller for it. And then suddenly his name has some sex appeal again. And is he a guy then that starts getting floated for some head coaching jobs, despite the fact that he's got a 3-31 record as a head coach, an interim head coach? I think that'll be really interesting to see is how he's perceived, how quickly people will forget his just disastrous stint at New Mexico and maybe give him another shot at a maybe not a big job, but sort of a second tier or mid-major type of job.
The answer is absolutely his name starts getting floated if we go down that rabbit hole. And he ends up getting the same benefit that every other coach that has come under Saban and emerged with new opportunities. I don't know though. Do you think that Loxley would look at that as an opportunity that he would chase to go have to, you know, play rebuild at another school?
I think he wants to be. I don't know if he may not take another New Mexico State type of gig or New Mexico, but he's. I don't think this is, Mike Loxley wants to be like Nick Saban's offensive coordinator for the rest of his career either. I think he's. I would imagine he still has aspirations to run a program. And hey, you know, what better way to get there than to be Nick Saban's coordinator? I mean, it's worked. It's we're on a pretty steady stretch of that working. And you know, even his offensive coordinators, you know, guys like Jim McElwain going on to get head gigs and move on to be successful. And so, you know, so yeah, I think I would think he'll chase some stuff down after that. And I'll tell you, Nick Saban then went out and hired a co-OC from stole a really good coach from James Franklin and Josh Gattis.
Ooh.
I don't know if you caught that, but Josh Gattis, the wide receivers coach at Penn State, heading to Alabama as I believe his title is co-OC and wide receivers coach. That I think is, a home run hire for Franklin. I mean, Gattis was one of James Franklin's best recruiters. He was with Franklin since his Vanderbilt days. But if you look at the receivers at Vanderbilt under James Franklin, at Penn State under James Franklin, the way those guys have developed from a technique and a polish developmental standpoint. He kills it in that realm.
Deshaun Hamilton is getting praises at the Senior Bowl workouts right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And Juwan Johnson made huge leaps year one to year two. You know, he's also, I mean, Jordan Matthews at Vanderbilt, I mean, two-star nobody recruit that became what, a second rounder. And even like his teammate at Vanderbilt, Jonathan Krause, kid went on to win a Super Bowl with the Patriots. You look at him, I saw him at the coaches convention. You would think he's a high school backup just looking at him, you know, and that kid developed into an NFL receiver under Gatta. So with all those talented freshman wide receivers at Alabama, I really think he's going to work some magic with those guys. Not that they need a lot of help, but it's going to be scary to see what he can accomplish with that crew.
Yeah, I was about to say, and if you are a wide receivers coach who really enjoys the fine arts and the details of the position, what could be more enticing than, oh, and by the way, here's Devonta Smith, Jerry Jeudy, you know, just these superstars.
Henry Ruggs.
Yeah, yeah.
They got a kid, Tyrell Shavers, who redshirted this year. He's like 6'6" and runs a 4.3. Like, they got some toys for him to play with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. Where would Mike Locksley be surface for? I haven't even started. I don't know if I want to go down this rabbit hole of which jobs are going to be open after the 2018 season. Like, we've literally just firmed up Arizona and everything else. Who knows? Right. Hey, I got it right now. Arizona State. Mike Locksley for Arizona State in 2019.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see.
Did you see our guy Herb?
Things going south quick.
Oh man, he was like, I can't believe that you got. It's not even the kids. You got to recruit the parents too. It's crazy.
You can't just go out and draft these guys.
Man, what's
you gotta call them on the phone. Yeah, you do.
Uh huh.
How it works?
You got to think that there's a lot of coaches. I know that a lot of coaches are friendly with each other. You got to think that on like there's a group chat of a bunch of coaches that are just like just dying every single time Herm goes out here with one of these quotes.
Especially out there in the Pac-12, who they're going to play against them. yeah, man, that is living up to my expectations of train wreckage. But I mean, not like right now we're still projecting. It's not like anything substantive has actually happened that's a train wreck, other than just like every appearance and like radio hit that he has, he further like cements the idea that he really didn't know what he was getting into.
Speaking of train wreck, now that Matt Canada has landed as the offensive coordinator at Maryland, which by the way, I'm gonna say good hire for Maryland.
He's had like 7 OC jobs in 9 years, I think, or something like that. I saw.
Do you think
now some of those were because he was, you know, jumping from place to place and following Dave Doran and you know, so there's some of those were just like leaving with the staff.
But Doran let him go. All right, so Doran let him go. He lands at Pitt, crushes it at Pitt, and gets hired by LSU as like a splash hire. Then doesn't vibe at all with Coach O, to the point that LSU will not answer questions about the offense in 2017. To the point that both parties, LSU and Canada, I believe, based on the way they're acting, are legally not permitted to discuss that relationship. This is ridiculous. This is a breakup of epic proportions.
Well, it all started with Troy when things leaked out after they lost to Troy that Ed Orgeron had told Matt Canada not to do more shifts and motions. Like, that's the whole offense. The whole offense is kissing around shifts, motions, jet sweeps, and Ed O told Canada to chill out on that, and they lose a game to Troy. So that was the cracks began there. I think both these guys are alpha type of personalities, and neither of them was going to sort of back down off of that. And I think things eroded quickly from there. So, like, I think it's to some degree, Matt Canada, like there's not a coincidence that he's gotten, you know, had all these jobs in 9 years. And he clearly isn't like the easiest guy to work for. But there's nothing about his offense this year that made me think he's not everything we thought he was from a coordinator. That he's not capable and really actually impressive as a coordinator. He's still a guy that when defensive coordinators don't want to play Matt Canada.
Listen, they had one of the best defensive fronts in Auburn running side to side. And yeah, like Auburn's offense did the defense no favors in the second half of that loss to LSU. But I mean, I looked at Canada as one of the one of the three stars of that win for LSU.
I agree. So Canada gets some of the blame, but I also think you got to hump a lot of it on Ogeron. And now that Canada's gone, and you look at LSU's roster, and so they're wide receiver heavy. Steve Ensminger is the promoted coach, the new coordinator. I have no reason to think he's not capable, but I think he steps into a tricky situation here. You are breaking in a new quarterback, probably Miles Brennan, who will be a true sophomore, got some snaps this year. Talented kid, but what do we ever really know about these quarterbacks until they get thrown into the fire? And for the first time in a long time, it's an anonymous running back score at LSU. They're losing a bunch of offensive line talent. They're wide receiver heavy. There's all this talk now that LSU is going to be relying on the strength of the offense, which is the wide receiver position. Okay, that sounds good, but when was the last time LSU was able to capitalize on wide receiver talent? I just think this, like, I'm a little bit in the, all right, is this the beginning of a downward trajectory for LSU right now? Like, I think you're on a little bit like a red alert right now if you're an LSU fan. I'm very curious to see what this 2018 season holds.
So I started, I was thinking, in the shower, as I always do when I'm thinking in the shower.
Good place to do it.
About the, if I was to fill out the SEC order of finish in both divisions, how would I do it? And I had a pretty good feeling about the East. I was like, Georgia 1, probably give like Florida 2. I'd have some trouble sort of figuring out how I was going to sort out South Carolina and Tennessee. I might give, I might get bullish on Missouri and talk myself into the Derek Dooley experience between now and July. But in the West, I was like, you know what? I might put LSU 5th. I don't know what about LSU in 2018 gives me confidence that they're going to be better than Joe Moorhead, Nicky Fitz led Mississippi State. You know, like, shoot, I don't know if Ole Miss is going to be a team that could beat LSU. Like, I'm looking at the SEC West, and I'm thinking that there's a very good chance that LSU could occupy one of those bottom, and especially if we're talking about the standings with the crossover against Florida, that they could occupy one of those bottom two or three spots in the division.
I agree. And especially when you look at, A&M's going to have their challenges as they transition into the Jimbo Fisher era, but they have hired a really impressive coaching staff. Auburn's going to be Auburn. Alabama's going to be Alabama. Mississippi State will return one of its best teams from a personnel standpoint in a long, long time. So I do kind of think that is a fair spot for LSU right now. And we'll learn more as we get into the spring and see how some of the young guys are progressing and that kind of thing. But man, it's hard to be like super bullish on LSU right now. And the fact that they feel like they got to pay their defensive coordinator $2.5 million doesn't inspire a lot of confidence either. I don't know. I'm just – LSU's got to – They need to prove something to me here in the coming spring season. I need to find a way to get confident in them again.
LSU's going to beat Auburn and show up against Alabama and lose, and then they're going to lose to Chad Morris and John Chavis again, lose to Arkansas. and lose to Ole Miss or something crazy like that.
Right.
I don't know.
I mean, that's reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about, do you think, what's your general feeling on Auburn going into next year? Because as a part of this thought experiment was, I was like, shoot, I might put Mississippi State too.
Well, I mean, I was sort of, with Auburn, I think they'll be even more pass friendly next year. I think at that point, the receiving core is going to be pretty good. I think Jarrett Stidham comes back, they'll have more comfortability in running an offense catered around him. The defense should still be good, particularly up front.
Aren't they losing a bunch, though?
I think they got it, but they still have like Nick Coe coming back, who's like a freak. They had two freshmen, like Big Cat Bryant and T.D. Moultrie, who like I think are going to really emerge next year. They've still got like Derek Brown, a defensive tackle. Like they've, part of the reason that defensive front was so good this year is it wasn't just a bunch of starters. It was, I mean, they could roll waves at you. So I think defensively they'll still be in really good shape.
Okay. So we've reached the point with Auburn where they've got like three or four classes of elite line play to the where we need to, like, you can assume that regardless of losing a bunch of seniors, they're still going to be really, really strong up front.
Yes, I think so. I think that the guys they have coming back, like Nick Coe, is probably a first round draft pick. Derek Brown is a high, you know, is a, you know, day one or two draft pick. Like I think once those guys become the feature guys, you'll see them flash. And then again, I think there's some true freshmen this year they're pretty excited about. So I think there's all kinds of beef still left over at Auburn.
Mm, love beef. One more news item, and then we'll get into some National Signing Day talk. Florida is going to be getting back running back Jordan Scarlett, wide receiver Rick Wells, linebacker James Houston, and linebacker Ventrell Miller. They were four of the players who served a season-long suspension from the credit card fraud case that ultimately resulted in the suspension of 9 players in 2017. Dan Mullen says that he's excited to have them back. We are looking at this, of these players that are back, do any of them change your outlook just in general, like when you're sort of looking at the Florida depth chart as you're expecting it for 2018?
No, not really. And when the suspensions came out, it was less that like any one guy hurts what they can produce on the field as much as it was the collection of all of them hurting their depth. And so I think getting bodies back and adding some depth is going to be beneficial. But no, I don't know that this is a game changer for me other than just kind of adding some bodies, when Florida started getting hurt, like the guys that were there playing were just, they weren't guys that should have been playing. And so that's the case with any SEC team. If you lose 10 guys, man, you're going to be in trouble. And that's not even counting the normal attrition that's sure to hit. So no, it didn't drastically change my perspective on Florida, though. That's how quickly Dan Mullen can get it going at Florida is one of my, is one of the storylines of 2018 that I'm sort of have no idea on. Like I'm just sort of interested.
Yeah. I think it's one of the most interesting and intriguing, for sure. I agree with you. The answer's no, but my reasoning is, mostly behind what we saw from Malik Davis when healthy as a freshman this year. I mean, he was tremendous.
Yeah, he was awesome.
He missed the final four games with a knee injury. If he comes back healthy and can be what he was, then getting Jordan Scarlett back is great. You know, he's a 5'10", 200, 10, 15 pound back that can, get in there and give you some good production. But to me, the potential star of that running back room is Jordan Scarlett. And then, Rick Wells at wide receiver. I feel like we've already seen, Tyree Cleveland, Tony. Like there's, again, like you said, this seems more like a depth issue than anything else. But it's interesting, man, because we're looking at Florida And Dan Mullen was one of those first-year coaches. Florida is one of the teams that you've got as a team to watch here for the close. But even with a shorter time, Dan Mullen, to me, and I think it ended up being one of your points that you wrote on, but the landing Emory Jones, like, was that the most impressive sort of individual move from the early signing period of one of the new coaches?
It was. I mean, Emory Jones was always going to, he was not going to end up at Ohio State. And so I think it was one of the most important because they beat Florida State on him. And there is not a quarterback on the roster at Florida right now that can do what Dan Mullen wants his quarterbacks to do. And Emory Jones is far from perfect. He is far from a finished product. And in most cases, I wouldn't say he's ready to play as a true freshman, but given how drastically different his skill set is compared to the guys on Florida's roster, like maybe that he does play. And I think at least Dan Mullen has his quarterback of the future to mold. And I think given Dan Mullen's track record molding quarterbacks and developing them, it gives you more confidence in Emory Jones' ability to get there. So I think that was a huge get for Florida. And, you know, they still got some work to do here down the home stretch, but that I think just in adding some athleticism to the quarterback room was critical.
So what is some of the work that that Florida has left? Like where are you keeping an eye on Mullen and his staff as we get down here to the final weeks and days before National Signing Day?
Well, they got 15 commits right now. I think they have room for like 8 more. I mean, there's plenty of room to add guys down the stretch. But I think really the area that's most important for Florida is offensive line. And I don't even necessarily know that that's like a need at Florida. Maybe it is. I'm not as versed enough in what the depth chart looks like as much as it's they've got an opportunity to land about 3 high-level 4-star and 5-star kids in the state of Florida that they probably would have otherwise gotten if not for the coaching change. And now Dan Mullen and his offensive line coach, John Hevesy, have to get in there and win some of these guys over. Richard Craze, who's a kid that's committed to Florida, is flirting with other programs. There's also William Barnes, who's probably was a longtime Florida lean out of Apopka, who's a top 100 kid, Army All-American. Suddenly, like, he's sort of leaning towards North Carolina, perhaps. And then there's the number one offensive tackle in the country, also out of Tampa, named Nicholas Petitfrere. And he is, again, a guy that, like, Florida kind of needed to get. And now, I mean, not now. I mean, he's always has been, up in the air. But Alabama, Ohio State, Notre Dame are all, like, very much factors, if not, you know, favorites in their own right. So, I mean, there's just a lot of tough battles left to win here for Florida, as it is with any of these new coaches. But I really think there's going to be kind of a referendum in some ways on the new coaching staff based on how some of these offensive linemen and some of these guys in the state start to lean.
So when Florida State had its early signing period, it was a smaller class. There were some good players in it, but one of the phrases that stuck out to me was that Willie Taggart talking about, you know, he's not going to fill numbers just to fill numbers. So they've certainly got a lot of room to add players in this for this second National Signing Day. Where have you seen Taggart and his staff getting out there? What do you see them? What kind of players do you see them chasing right now, and who are they in the running for?
Well, I mean, they're kind of working on two fronts here. They're working on the Florida front and then the West Coast / national front. Because remember, Willie Taggart was recruiting pretty heavily out of the state of Florida while he was at Oregon, and now he's coming into to Florida State, and he's, you know, I expected him to sort of just easily flip a lot of these guys over to Florida State. Hadn't been as easy as that. He's done it with a couple, but guys like Warren Thompson, a big-bodied receiver out of Florida. Guys like Malcolm Lamar, a big defensive end out of the Tampa area. Like, those are guys that they're really working on. But they also have – I mean, they They've gotten some West Coast commits as well, and they got more to come. They're hoping. I mean, Jalen Hall, a big Army All-American four-star receiver out of Long Beach Poly. You know, they're trying to get this kid Treshawn Harrison, who's sort of this do-it-all athlete out of Washington. They're very much in the mix for those guys. They're trying to flip a commit from Kentucky out of Ohio. James Foster's their quarterback. They're trying to land. He's out of the state of Alabama. They're battling Jimbo Fisher and Texas A&M for him. So there's a lot of action out there, and it's sort of, again, it's on like a multi-front with them recruiting very nationally. You have to if you're filling up this late with big numbers. So I think Florida State closes pretty well, relatively speaking. Do they get into like the top 10? That'll be probably a tall task, but I think they start creeping up towards the top 15.
Well, I remember, all right, so Jimbo Fisher always a great closer at Florida State. And so if you were a Texas A&M fan after watching the early signing period come and go, you know, you kind of had in your head the memories of all those five-star dudes who would pull out Florida State hats and start doing the tomahawk chop on National Signing Day in February in years past. Do you think that the Aggies are set to, like, I'm not always as clued into the calculator. You know, I don't always do the 24/7 sports class calculator. The simulations are very, very fun to play with. And diehards are, you know, if you've got your team, it's awesome to sort of figure out, you know, where you can land, what your score can be. But when you're looking at Texas A&M's class, is it going to be a place where Jimbo can close and can kind of solidify a group that can give Texas A&M something to build on as they make, as you mentioned earlier, sort of that transition from Sumlin to Fisher?
I think this was one of the tougher jobs anybody had, because A, in the state of Texas, it's gotten to be really competitive. Alabama's done a great job in the state. Texas is having a huge year recruiting. They're number three in the country. There's a lot of teams coming in. I mean, even last year, like Ohio State, Stanford, and LSU were the teams that got all the top 10 players. And so now here comes Jimbo Fisher, high expectations, you know, no room for failure. And he's bringing in a staff that's almost entirely non-Texas. I mean, it's a really good group of recruiters, but not a lot of guys that have been stationed in the state here for a while. And I think that, again, like he got hired fairly late, and so they tried to take some big swings at guys to get them on campus for official visits right before the dead period. Didn't get them signed. In fact, they often signed elsewhere, and so now here they are, and they have, you know, they got to make up some ground. So they'll be able to do it. They'll be able to get some names. I mentioned James Foster, the quarterback that they're battling with Florida State for. You know, they've got guys like Isaac Taylor Stewart out west, a five-star cornerback that they're battling Alabama and USC for. Jalen Waddle, a big, like a really dynamic slot receiver. You know, Christian Kirkish that they're battling for, you know, Alabama for as well. So if you know, you sort of listen to the way this plays out, like they've got a lot of really tough competition for these guys and a lot of other teams that have a much better head start for them. So I think that Florida State, or I think Texas A&M will have some, you know, they'll make up some grounds, but it's a lot to ask for them to like finish as one of like the upper tier SEC teams. You know, they'll be kind of middle of the pack by the time National Signing Day rolls around, will be my expectation. Anything higher than that, man, huge win for Jimbo Fisher.
Let's just hope that a lot of these top prospects are boot guys.
I am a boot guy.
That helps. You know, you better be a boot guy.
I am a boot guy.
I almost have this like not a defeatist mentality, but when you mention this, like, oh, and you know, they're going to be going up against Alabama and they're going up against Florida State, like it. There is, in all the different simulations that this runs, there is one where like Texas A&M just ends up falling short on a lot of those guys, and vibes will not be good heading into the fall or heading into spring.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah, I think there's that's the scenario.
Yes, this
but hey, they got our guy Elko, so defense will be okay.
Defense will be all right. All right, Kay. couple more schools before we get out of here. The Alabama sort of it was like on the early signing period, Alabama kind of got fell below the fold. You know, they kind of fell to page three as it was really Georgia's time to shine. Alabama, of course, thanks to Tua Tagovailoa and a second and 26 that will be remembered forever, certainly jumped back on top in terms of sort of the conversation and the pecking order. Unrelated, you know, the on-field and the recruiting efforts are both, 12-month machines, in my opinion, that are both running at the same time. And so as we look to Alabama's recruiting efforts, we got some staff turnover, but they are going to be in a position to still finish with one of the top classes in the SEC and one of the top classes in the country. Do you see the Tide making a run at Georgia's number one spot?
Yes. And for the record, Ohio State is currently sitting number one.
Oh.
They've been jostling back and forth here as rankings have updated. Like, with the 24/7 Sports composite, that's what we use in our team rankings, is those player rankings. And with the Rivals.com update, they were so close that just that rankings update put Ohio State above Georgia. So as I see it, and I'm writing a story on this today for CBS, it probably is out by the time this podcast will be out. There are three teams that can finish with the number one class in the country: Georgia, Ohio State, and Alabama. And Alabama's finish would take it wouldn't take a miraculous finish, but it would take a near perfect finish, getting guys like Pat Surtain Jr. or Tyson Campbell, five-star defensive backs, and maybe even another five-star defensive back and Isaac Taylor Stewart. It would take them getting guys like Jaylen Waddle. It would take them. It would just sort of take they'd have to
like a waterfall effect or windfall, yeah, where it's just it's like the story of National Signing Day. Everyone's going Alabama,
right? Nicholas Petit-Frere, the number one offensive tackle, would have to go. They'd probably have to flip J.J. Peterson from Tennessee. Like, and as I say all these, like, not a single one of these is far-fetched. Now, throw them all together, that's tougher to envision that they just get all of them. But individually, like, none of these are tough to imagine. So if they had that kind of a perfect finish and cut into Ohio State or Alabama or Georgia by getting one of the guys that, you know, those teams needed for their perfect finish, then all of a sudden I think Alabama could have a shot at number one. But it would be it's long odds on that.
So what do we think? That would be number eight in a row?
It would be eight in a row. So and the last class that was the last number one class that wasn't a Nick Saban class was an Urban Meyer class at Florida. And it looks very possible, in fact, more likely that Ohio State ends up with a number one class than Alabama does. And so, you know, Urban could have handed the crown to Nick Saban and could be taking it right back from him 7 years later. So that'll certainly be something to pay attention to. And beyond the SEC, too, the team probably that could make the biggest just sort of move in the rankings, they're sitting at 11th right now. USC, there's a scenario that could see USC land as high as like number two. I think that's unlikely, but they're going to close really strong. Probably ends up with like a top five type of class. You know, they've got Elijah Griffin and Isaac Taylor Stewart out west that they think they can get, both, you know, two of the top five cornerbacks in the country. They've got, you know, just like Penei Sewell, a big offensive tackle that Alabama's chasing. Like, USC's in the mix there as well. There's a pretty significant number of targets out there that USC is still chasing. Guys like Devon Williams and Solomon Tuliapupu and some of these guys out west that are sort of the last big names remaining, USC is leading, if not, you know, just sort of in the mix with them.
Man, USC crushes it.
They always, that's the team that just like always closes strong.
Yeah.
Like every year. It doesn't even really matter who the coach is. Like they're going to close.
No, really, it does not matter who the coach is. Like you could really I think that Clay Helton is a good coach. He's very good with the media, and sometimes I'll sit down and watch, you know, his little his discussions. He shoots them at his desk, puts them on YouTube, and it's kind of insightful. He's a good football coach, but damn, if he's not a little bit of the creative coach on EA Sports NCAA 14 sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, just like pull out your coach mold and just pull it, you know.
Default. But hey, he can still get it done. Man, that's good. All right, one last one before we get out of here. Our boy Jeremy Pruitt, Tennessee.
Yeah, I think that's the one. That's the one right now that is making the most noise. Like that's the one that I think is sort of the landscape shifting hire from a recruiting standpoint to me, because as we look at like why Alabama might not get the number one class, it's because Kirby Smart is doing so much damage at Georgia, and now Jeremy Pruitt is sort of having the same kind of impact at Tennessee. And so I think it's just making the landscape more rigorous, more treacherous for Nick Saban with the guys that he sort of molded and shepherded into these positions. I mean, Tennessee is all of a sudden, I've said this on some radio show somewhere, like that's the school right now that if I'm a head coach in college football and one of my commits tells me he's taking an official visit to Tennessee, like that's the school where I'm like, damn, like, uh-oh, come on, like let's talk about this. Like, you don't want to go over there. Like, I don't want him on campus. I don't want him anywhere close to Knoxville. It's just the staff that he's put together, the way that he approaches it, the track record he's got. I mean, it's scary. And, I mean, J.J. Peterson, the kid that was out of South Georgia, top 100 Army All-American kid, he would be an Alabama signee probably right now if not for Jeremy Pruitt going to Tennessee. And now instead of, you know, he committed to Tennessee without ever even visiting the program just because, you know, not just because, but largely because of Jeremy Pruitt.
Wow. Good stuff. He is Barton Simmons. You can follow him on Twitter at Barton Simmons. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. The days are counting down. National Signing Day. Barton's going to be part of our live video coverage, which we believe will be on CBS Sports HQ, but definitely available on CBSSports.com. Barton, keep your head up, man. This is time to close and lock up the commitments.
This is the this is the home stretch, man.
Home stretch.
Stay focused.
All right, appreciate it, dude.
All right.